pretty well fixed on trying to have nuclear weapon capabilities.
While the U.S. president tweets one way, the U.S. seems to be hardening its position on Pyongyang. This is Tuesday, September 11th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. You are invited to join our conversation on VOA Asia Facebook. Also ahead, we explore reports of human rights violations by China against its Uyghur population. The U.S. issues a reprimand and a warning to the International Criminal Court. And a new antibiotic-resistant bug has been found in Australia. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Last week, President Donald Trump used his Twitter feed to thank North Korean leader Kim Jong-un for proclaiming his unwavering faith after a South Korean official said that Kim wanted to denuclearize before the end of Trump's first term. The U.S. president tweeted, "We will get it done together." However, a report from NBC News said while that steady stream of praise for Kim Jong-un from Mr. Trump continues, his administration is taking a much more aggressive stance toward Pyongyang. I spoke with Bruce Bennett, the senior defense analyst at the RAND Corporation think tank, about the U.S. position on North Korea.
North Korea is pretty well fixed on trying to have nuclear weapon capabilities. The president is hopeful he can convince them otherwise. Kim Jong-un has promised he will abandon his nuclear weapons. But we know that even given the record of Kim's family since 1992, when they agreed to have no nuclear weapons ever, that they haven't exactly kept their commitments. So the president's hopeful, but I think we also have to be realistic.
Where is the proof coming from that they are continuing to assemble and make new nuclear weapons?
Well, North Korea does a great job of denying us information. What we can tell is that the facilities that would be involved in creating critical nuclear materials and then potentially in weaponizing seem to be very active. We don't have anybody on place to count the number of weapons, but it's been discussed in the media that North Korea can produce 12 weapons a year, and the North Korean objective appears to be to have something like 50 ICBMs and nuclear weapons to go on top of them so that in the future they can coerce the United States and do pretty much what they want to without the U.S. being willing to take action against them. So we're assuming that they're simply moving ahead based upon the meager evidence that we have and no evidence that Kim has stopped, which you would think if he wanted an agreement, he would be demonstrating.
Do you think that the summit between Trump and Kim Jong-un accomplished anything?
Well, they certainly established more of a relationship than they had before that. President Trump, again, is hopeful that somehow he can convince Kim that it's really in his best interest to abandon his nuclear weapons. That's a bit of a long shot. It could happen. And certainly the president should be trying to do it before he takes any kind of military or other serious action against North Korea. And so it's the first step in terms of trying to get to some kind of reasonable outcome.
Do you think that there is an internal battle in Pyongyang between factions that want to go along with denuclearization and those who do not? Or do they all say, no, we're not going to do it?
Well, there could well be factions. Now, it's unlikely that any of them are telling Kim Jong-un he's taking the wrong approach, because they would be dead shortly thereafter. But there likely are different groups who have a feeling that nuclear weapons is not the right way to go. It's cost the economy and the people of North Korea severely to pay for this program. And so I suspect there probably are people in North Korea who would support a denuclearization. And Kim may be prepared to eliminate some weapons. The question is he really prepared to go anywhere close to zero?
Is there any additional pressure placed on North Korea by South Korea's recent moves?
Oh, I think it's probably the opposite, that while South Korea has talked about being firmly supporting denuclearization, their attitude has been that the key solution to the North Korean problem is peaceful coexistence. And that peaceful coexistence means essentially accepting what North Korea will offer them. What North Korea wants right now is a peace agreement before the conditions for peace are set. Given a country like North Korea that doesn't keep their agreements to agree to peace before the conditions for peace are set is not a very wise approach.
Where do you think the U.S. government stands on North Korea?
I think many in the government are skeptical that North Korea will ever eliminate its nuclear weapons. I think they hoped that with the Singapore agreement that Kim Jong-un would at least be willing to demonstrate a degree of sincerity by giving up a few nuclear weapons and closing a few facilities. Since he has refused not only to take any real action and is stuck on just saying he's someday going to do it, there's a great deal of skepticism that's grown into the government about whether or not there's any chance that he will go to zero. He could overcome some of that skepticism by actually taking some real actions, but so far his words aren't doing it.
Bruce Bennett added that President Trump should be prepared to tell Kim Jong-un that North Korea should surrender its nuclear weapons to a third party, such as France, or the U.S. will resume its military maneuvers in the area. We invite you now to read more on our top story by following us on Facebook, VOA Asia, and the VOAnews.com website. These are among the top Asia stories you'll find right now at VOAnews.com. A former Cambodian opposition leader who faces controversial treason charges has been released on bail due to poor health and following an international outcry, but he'll remain under house arrest. A senior executive for an international human rights group was deported to Malaysia after being detained by Vietnamese authorities. Following a major earthquake in Japan, authorities have set up 8 refugee camps in the hardest-hit town of Atsuma, where 42 people were killed in the quake. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. Human Rights Watch Monday condemned what it called China's mass systemic campaign of human rights violations against the Turkic Muslim Uyghur minority in the northwest Xinjiang region. Its 117-page report, based primarily on dozens of interviews with former residents, documents what it called forced political indoctrination, collective punishment, various personnel and religious restrictions, and mass surveillance. China launched a crackdown on violent extremism in 2014, but denies the existence of internment camps, preferring to call them education and training centers to assist in rehabilitation and reintegration. Brad Adams, Human Rights Watch Asia director, spoke with VOA's Victor Beatty about that report.
People might want to debate where it's worse to be a Muslim. Obviously, the Burmese have persecuted the Rohingya very badly. But this is a systematic campaign, top to bottom, approved by the leadership in Beijing, carried out by the Communist Party in Xinjiang province, where Uyghurs, simply because they are Uyghurs and they're Muslims, are subjected to arbitrary detention in the education camps. They're tortured in police custody and they're mistreated. And there are, you know, very extensive controls on their daily lives to try to essentially have them stop any kind of public practice of being a Muslim.
This comes just after the UN Human Rights Panel in August said China is believed to be holding up to 1 million ethnic Uyghurs in secretive system of internment camps. Is that what Human Rights Watch found?
Yeah, I mean, internment camps are a little strong because they suggest Nazi Germany or even what the Burmese are doing with some Rohingya. But they are detention camps for sure. They are surrounded by barbed wire. People are brought into them for no reason at all, often simply for a public display of being a Muslim, for having a beard, for praying in a way that the authorities don't like, for trying to talk to other people about Islam. And they are held in custody and they go through re-education. And that's something, of course, that happened during the Mao period frequently. It was part of the staple of the Cultural Revolution. And it's still been part of the Chinese political culture ever since through things like re-education through labor and other programs. So the Chinese know how to do re-education well. It's part of their toolbox when they want to persecute groups. And then people are sometimes held for weeks, months, and longer. Their families often are not allowed to have contact with them. They don't know what's happened to them. And they're basically told, you need to be a good Chinese citizen. You need to love the Communist Party. You need to love China. You need to understand that China is a great country. And you need to stop practicing Islam in such a strong or devotional way.
China has branded such reports untrue, saying the education training centers to which minor criminals, quote-unquote, are assigned serve merely to assist in their rehabilitation, reintegration, even vocational training for jobs.
Well, we spoke to former detainees and their relatives. We written a 117-page report. I would encourage the Chinese government, for once, to actually read the reports that they say are untrue before coming to a conclusion. Quite clear they haven't read the report yet, and they might learn something. Of course, at the highest levels of the Chinese government and in the Ministry of Public Security, they certainly know what is in the report is true because they're the ones who carry it out. You know, the Chinese government is just becoming very powerful, and it's becoming increasingly arrogant and dismissive of criticisms, even by well-meaning Chinese people, even by people within the Chinese Communist Party, even by academics and other people who are affiliated with the Chinese government. There are many Chinese scholars who have been warning the Chinese government that carrying out this kind of policy and also denying it is simply going to alienate the Uyghur community. If they're trying to avoid radicalization, that this kind of policy is going to lead to a vicious circle and actually probably lead to the results that the Chinese government say they're trying to avoid. In other words, the Uyghur population is going to get angry. They're going to be alienated from the Chinese government. And some of them are going to want to do something about it. And that may not be peaceful in nature.
Brad Adams said it's very difficult to confront China on rights issues. He said while this should be taken up by the UN, Muslim countries like Pakistan and Afghanistan, which have close ties to Beijing, should speak or be speaking out about what's going on in Xinjiang. He also said groups like the Organization for Islamic Cooperation, who has taken a stand on the treatment of Rohingya Muslims in Myanmar, should be just as concerned about the welfare of the Uyghurs. Happening now in Asia, the Islamist Taliban in northern Afghanistan has captured a strategically important district near the border with Turkmenistan and threatened a provincial capital, killing dozens of Afghan troops in a series of battlefield attacks. A court in Singapore has ordered $11 million in seized funds be returned to Malaysia as part of efforts to recover misappropriated money from Malaysia's IMDb State Investment Fund. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happy you're with us on VOA Asia. U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton has delivered a scathing assessment of the International Criminal Court and threatened sanctions if it goes ahead with a proposed investigation into allegations of war crimes by U.S. military and intelligence personnel in Afghanistan. The alleged war crimes involve reports from secret detention facilities in Afghanistan and on the territory of other nations who were party to the ICC, particularly between 2003 and 2004. Bolton, speaking Monday at the Conservative Federalist Society in Washington, called the ICC ineffective and unaccountable and outright dangerous. The ICC was established in 2002 and was designed to independently investigate war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. But Bolton said the court's definitions of crimes, especially crimes of aggression, are vague and subject to wide-ranging interpretation. He issued a warning to the court if it went through with its investigation.
I want to deliver a clear and unambiguous message on behalf of the President of the United States. The United States will use any means necessary to protect our citizens and those of our allies from unjust prosecution by this illegitimate court. We will not cooperate with the ICC. We will provide no assistance to the ICC, and we certainly will not join the ICC.
Bolton said if the ICC carries out the investigation of U.S. military actions, the United States would ban its judges and prosecutors from entering the country, freeze any funds they have in U.S. financial institutions, and attempt to prosecute them in U.S. courts. Coming your way, a new superbug has been discovered in Australia. You're listening to VOA Asia.
What is it like to study in the United States, and what do you have to do to get here? The Student Union is VOA's blog that follows students from all over the world as they face challenges and opportunities of studying at American universities. Log on at blogs.voanews.com/student-union.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi and Pakistan's new Prime Minister Imran Khan have agreed to promote economic cooperation between their two countries. China says it will respond if the United States takes any new steps on trade. That declaration comes after President Trump warned he was ready to slap tariffs on virtually all Chinese imports into the United States. Visit VOA Asia Facebook every day for top stories and great features. This is VOA Asia. We continue now. An Urdu couplet goes, "Get up and gird your loins, then see what God does." A group of young and disabled boys and girls in Indian-administered Kashmir did just that. They decided to show their caliber by doing something out of the ordinary: wheelchair basketball. A three-day wheelchair basketball workshop held in the capital of Srinagar attracted about 24 participants who astonished everyone by their performances. VOA's Zubair Dar and Yusuf Jamil tell us more in this report narrated by Bezan Hamdard.
Being born disabled is one thing, but becoming disabled comes with phases of acceptance. The newfound activity of wheelchair basketball has forever changed the lives of these young men and women. Some now seemingly glow with a new determination.
When I got into an accident, I went into a state of deep depression. I had no desire to live. My parents were also suffering with me. But ever since I've picked up this game, I've been really feeling good. And now I'm a national player. I'm representing my state. It feels really good.
Insha Bashir and about two dozen other disabled young people recently participated in a three-day wheelchair basketball workshop in Srinagar. Wheelchair basketball is played by people with varying physical disabilities and is a sport played in the Paralympics.
The purpose of this is to teach them wheelchair basketball so that there is more inclusion through the sport. Kashmir is promoting girls this time, and we have four players, and I am very confident that the girls will also participate in the upcoming competitions.
The nearly three-decade-old turmoil in Indian-administered Kashmir has led to an increase in the number of disabled locals. Bashir feels that it is important not to lose hope.
Basketball has become part of my life, and I would like to say that you should never give up in life. It takes time, and you face problems so much that accepting becomes tough. It takes time for everyone.
In order to lift spirits and motivate participants, the workshop's organizers preach their motto every chance they get: my ability is stronger than my disability. For Zubair Dar and Yusuf Jamil in Srinagar, this is Bejan Hamdard, VOA News.
This news alert from VOA Asia reports a South Korea's government plans to send about 200 delegates to accompany President Moon Jae-in on his planned trip to the North next week. China urged the United States Monday not to gesticulate or make irresponsible remarks about governments dropping diplomatic support for self-ruled Taiwan. Police in Thailand Monday shut down a forum organized by foreign journalists to discuss whether senior military officers in Myanmar should face justice for alleged human rights abuses. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. Now on VOA Asia, a new superbug that is resistant to all known antibiotics, it's resistant to them, has been discovered by Australian scientists. They say the megabacteria has been spreading in hospitals around the world, unrecognized for years. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Staphylococcus epidermis is a type of bacteria commonly found on human skin. Researchers in Australia have found several strains of the so-called superbug that have mutated in hospitals to be resistant to almost all antibiotics, causing near untreatable infections. They analysed samples from 78 institutions in 10 countries and found those bacteria that were resistant to drugs were in Europe. Ben Howden is a professor at the Melbourne-based Peter Doherty Institute for Infection and Immunity.
In Australia, the strains that we've been able to detect so far are still susceptible to some really last-line antibiotics, which are quite expensive and can be a bit toxic, but at least we do have active antibiotics, whereas some of the strains from overseas are actually essentially untreatable with resistance to all antibiotics to treat this type of infection.
Professor Howden says hospital authorities around the world need to do more to monitor and prevent the spread of the superbug. Staphylococcus epidermis doesn't always lead to an infection, but in a small number of patients, it can cause serious illness that requires complex treatment. The so-called superbug is most dangerous to people in the hospital with a compromised immune system, or those who are recovering from surgery or who have implanted medical devices. The Australian research team says their study is another example of the overuse of antibiotics that's driving bacteria to become less responsive to modern medicine. The research has been published in the journal Nature Microbiology. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
A replacement bridge being built near a busy U.S. port is being fitted with seismic sensors that will measure earthquake activity in one of the country's most earthquake-prone regions. This new span is just a few miles from two active faults capable of quakes with a magnitude range of 6.5 to 7. Faith Lapidus reports.
The Gerald Desmond Bridge stretches over the port of Long Beach, the nation's second busiest port. It's a crucial route for cargo trucks and Southern California commuters. Built in 1968, the roadway is reaching the end of its natural life. Next year, it will be replaced by a new bridge that will do more than carry traffic over the port. It will provide information for engineers and seismologists about the forces it's subjected to during an earthquake.
We're going to instrument the bridge and the bridge foundations with about 75 sensors or accelerometers that actually measure the accelerations that are imparted from a seismic event or any other thing that would cause strong ground motions.
That data, including a quake's magnitude, how fast the ground is moving, and at what trajectory it hits the bridge, will be transmitted automatically to scientists around the state so they can analyze it and add it to their database of earthquake knowledge.
There are bridges in California that have sensors in them, but this was the first time that we've been able to design from the beginning to incorporate those sensors into the design of the structure.
The new bridge has been designed to last 100 years. Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Americans on Tuesday will mark the 17th anniversary of the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks that claimed almost 3,000 lives. President Donald Trump will attend a ceremony at the 9/11 Memorial in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, near where United Airlines Flight 93 crashed after passengers retook control from the Al-Qaeda-affiliated terrorist who had hijacked the plane. In a statement, the White House declared September 7th through 9th as National Days of Prayer and Remembrance for the victims of the attacks. You've been listening to VOA Asia. Get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud. Download our podcast. Take VOA Asia with you. Find us at voanews.com. And let's hear from you. VOA Asia Facebook and our email at voaasia@voanews.com. Our thanks for joining us, and our thank you to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Greg Burns, our managing editor, Diane Gao, and the VOA Asia team, Jim Stevenson, Skylar Ogden, and Doug Bernard. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Enjoy your day.